Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is, you know, on your computer or downloading it to an iPod. Today, we really have a very special show. This is a unique one, as we talk to law students who are taking electronic discovery courses at three different law schools around the country, the University of Florida, the University of Alabama, and the University of Texas. Sort of as an intro, here is something that Judge Shinlin and Ralph Losey said. I'm going to read a transcript from an earlier podcast I did on ESI Bytes on the importance of teaching law school students electronic discovery. Judge Shinlin was talking, and she said, We just said that the practice of law today involves nothing but electronic records. We used to say there's e-discovery as if it was a subset of all discovery, but now there's no other discovery. As the world shifts to electronic records, there are no paper records, and by the time today's graduates become lawyers, they will see hard copy as a thing of the past. Boxes, warehouses, sorting through paper, I really don't think that there's going to be the way that's going to be the way they're going to practice. It's all electronic. So if they don't learn the techniques for working with electronic records efficiently, for thinking in advance about such things as form of production, search terms, search techniques. If they're not up to speed, they're going to just fall out. I mean, they're not going to cut it in the new world. Those of us who are a little older, shall I say modestly or immodestly, but it's too late for us, we really can't change completely. But for these young people coming out of the world, we'll change with them. So it must be taught in law schools. I think it would be almost malpractice for a law school to graduate a young lawyer these days and not to have exposed them to the very important and fascinating issues of e-discovery. Ralph, do you agree with that? And Ralph Losey said, I totally. I was just going to be teaching law school again tomorrow at the University of Florida. I go up there once a week. There's real enthusiasm there. The students, not only that, they get it so much better than the CLEs I do. Plus, they have the time to really study it and get it. I mean, it takes just for one semester, and we do a two-credit course, which is typical of the law students that offer it. You're talking about 150 hours of dedicated study, including the 2 hours a week classroom and 3 to 4 hours a week of reading assignments and then preparing for the final exam. This is what it takes. It's a complicated subject, and it's frankly embarrassing. There are so few law schools that are now teaching it. But I think that will change soon, particularly with Judge Shinlin's excellent course book and the books I've written. There's no excuse now for law schools not to add it in. So that opening sets the table for today's show, which I consider a follow-up to one of the first ESI Bytes shows we did. And personally, I'm going out on a limb here, but I'm sure no one in electronic discovery has ever attempted to talk to law students in a public forum on electronic discovery before. Myself, Ralph Losey, Julie Grantham, who's at the University of Texas, and Allison Skinner from the University of Alabama thought it would be an interesting opportunity to talk to future lawyers who've grown up surrounded by technological tools, what their impression of e-discovery is, and the utility of the courses they're taking. I mentioned this to Judge Grimm, who also teaches courses, and he said he'd love to be on the show. So here we are. You know, these are graduating law students. This may be their last chance to publicly comment on this space until they make partner or become senior associates at law firms. They've been uncorrupted by the politics of working in a law firm in the real world of litigation. So maybe they have useful insights which they can share today to help today's lawyers deal with the problems we face today. The other special guest I mentioned today is Judge Grimm, who's agreed to co-host this show. He also teaches electronic discovery at the University of Maryland and at the University of Baltimore. Judge Grimm really doesn't need much of an introduction. He's a full-time magistrate judge for the United States District Court of the University for the District of Maryland. He's appointed in February of 1997, frequent lecturer, author of cases such as Mancia versus Mayflower Textile Services, Victor Stanley v. Creative Pipe, Hobson versus the Mayor of Baltimore, or versus City of Baltimore, and Lorraine versus Markel American Insurance Company. Judge Grimm, thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure, Carl.
Okay, so starting off here, before we talk about electronic discovery, why don't we sort of go around? I'm going to call on each individually to introduce yourself and any technological background you might have. Why don't we start at the University of Florida? Jared Beckerman?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a second-year law student at the University of Florida. My tech background, I studied computer science as an undergrad. Now I'm the incoming editor-in-chief of the Journal of Technology, Law, and Policy, and I run Linux at home, so I guess that makes me a geek as well.
Okay, you're a geek lawyer to be, so okay. Rob Davis?
Yes, hi there. I'm a 3L law student at the University of Florida. My tech background is probably not as great as some others on the call. I basically had a computer in about 10 or 15 years ago and just kind of plucked around on it, and that was the extent of it. And then when I read about Professor Losey, Professor Losey's e-discovery class, thought it would be interesting, and have been very pleasantly surprised about everything we've been learning. It certainly is the one of the future aspects of the field of law.
Okay, and Andrew Roy?
Carl, I'm a 2L student at the University of Florida, and I haven't had much technical background. Last year, actually, I rebuilt my Sony desktop with a bunch of parts from Newegg, and that was quite a challenge for me. But in terms of my technical background, I've just always kind of grown up with a computer, and I figured this would be a great experience to learn about e-discovery, and so we've pretty much had two semesters of it at this point.
If you rebuild a computer, you're a geek, okay? I'm sorry, Andrew. Anyway, let's go to the University of Alabama. Ryan Tyler?
Yes, I'm a 3L. My computer background is I majored in computer science and engineering at the University of South Florida. I also got my master's in computer engineering from the same university. I'm a former engineer, network engineer for T. Rowe Price and Associates, and I've been around computers all my life.
Okay, and Justin Ladner.
I'm a 3L. My background is not as computer-focused as some of the other students, but I've got a undergraduate and master's degree in material and metallurgical engineering. That's really the extent of my technical background.
Okay, that's good. And then Laura Beth Turner from the University of Texas.
I have the least of the technical background, definitely. I'm a 3L at UT, and my background is actually in communication. I have my bachelor's and master's in communication. So the classes that I'm taking this semester are kind of focusing on getting more of a practical knowledge for what I'm going to need whenever I get out and I'm practicing and doing the litigation side of things. And so bringing that into a smaller firm and having a new perspective for the smaller firm. So I'm learning everything in this class as I go.
Okay, and I did see Joshua Norman on the chat line. I'm trying to see if he's on the phone line. If you're on, Josh, tell us your background. If not, we'll just go on to the next question. Nope, almost on. All right, why don't we go on the show first of all? And I want to mention I thought I'd have a funny question. I was doing a poll of who owns albums or cassette tapes and who owns watches, thinking no one in the group would have it. They're just like us. Listeners, they all own watches. Almost all of them have some albums or cassettes. So there's a stereotyping is not always a good thing. So anyway, Judge Grimm, why don't you start off here? If you have some questions you want to ask?
Sure. Let me just say that I don't have currently any LPs, but I certainly have in the past had them. So I am two-thirds of the same. Same experience as everybody else. I have a question for Laura, and that is ask her to volunteer, if she'd be willing to do so, what she finds about the discovery course that she has taken that distinguishes it when she compares it to the other law school courses that she has taken that deal with sort of litigation, such as civil procedure, or evidence or trial practice, those types of classes, and what she is finding from the e-discovery class that she thinks would be helpful for what she can imagine herself doing as a lawyer when she graduates that is not presently provided in the basic civil procedure or trial practice or evidence classes.
As far as what's offered in my other courses, for my pretrial strategy and my civil procedure, we've touched really briefly on e-discovery, and it's kind of this is an important thing, and here's maybe one case or one example, and that's as much as we get into it. And I think that having a class that specializes specifically in that allows us to kind of gain that knowledge as these things are developing, because it is something that's still so new, you know, and growing and changing all the time, more so than the rest of the law is. And for me, kind of the reason that I took it, and I briefly mentioned this, I work at a smaller firm, and there are three other attorneys at the firm, and they all have 15-plus years experience. And so they all know a lot more than I do, obviously, about practicing and about litigation and civil procedure and all these things because they have that experience. But taking this class gives me an opportunity to bring something new to the table, that everybody kind of gets used to doing things in a certain way and asking these certain questions. And to a certain extent, because it's a smaller firm, we don't have the same level of sophisticated clients that a lot of these e-discovery cases deal with, but there are just going to be a lot of things that are growing and changing. And that's something that allows me to bring something new to the table where, yes, they have a lot more experience than I do, but I have something that will hopefully make the practice more efficient. We'll learn how to change the way that we do discovery. And because I have this smaller, more informal firm environment, it's easy enough for me to come in and say, hey, here's what I'm learning. Here's something that I think we need to do, where I can go in and talk to the partners and they'll actually listen, versus maybe at a bigger firm, there are these things already in place and these attorneys studying it and things like that because they have the manpower for that, where we don't. And so it falls on me a little bit more than it would maybe in a larger firm where several people are developing these things and checking these things. So.
Great. Sort of a similar question to you, Justin Ladner. Do you think electronic discovery has been a worthwhile course, and why? And the reason I'm asking this is, not all law schools offer these courses, and some schools pretty much have decided not to after considering this. So I want to get your impressions on the course.
Carl, I think, the reading that you mentioned start the podcast off about Professor Losey's comments on how important it is. I mean, I echo those same comments. For me personally, it's been an educational process about a topic that I knew very little about. It's very important for me to be taking this class because the firm where I've accepted a job, although it sounds like it's a little bit larger than Laura's, they've got they're a complex litigation firm with a lot of large-scale automotive manufacturers. One of them is that they're national counsel for. And although they're larger, they still don't have a strong grasp on all the fundamentals of e-discovery. And when I come in, I know there's going to be an expectation that I'm going to have an understanding of this. So it's definitely going to be vital for me to understand all the protocols and concepts, because it's an area that I'm going to be assisting in on the larger litigation matters as far as, Rule 34, forms of production. Through the class, doing the case analysis, we learned to be very specific about the ESI, the format, don't leave any stones unturned, and also the communication that needs to be done to the clients and to older partners, anybody on the team, is really something that's very, very important. So it's probably the most important class I've taken this semester, without a doubt.
Great. And before we go to the next question, I just want to offer all of you a chance, and once you go out working, email me back. I'd love to do a follow-up show to hear about knowledge transfer, if you've been able to practically educate the people, the lawyers that you're working with, who are also teaching you how to practice law. I think that'd be a great show. Okay, let's go to, I guess, the next question here.
Yeah, this is Paul Grimm for Jared. We know, of course, that Ralph Losey has authored two books, at least, the most recent of which has just come out from the ABA, and Judge Shindlin and Professor Dan Capra up at Fordham have authored a textbook that contained a broad sampling of information that would be useful in structuring an ESI discovery course. But by no means do you have to have a textbook in the in the standard form. And some would even say that given the fact, for example, that just in the early part of this year, in the first quarter that we have, we've had two very significant ESI opinions, one in the pension committee case issued in January by Judge Shindlin, and the other issued in the Rimkus by Judge Rosenthal, and obviously those cases are, each one of them is well over 75 pages long and extremely important in terms of discussing things like duties to preserve and spoliation and the sanctions and the showings and the burdens and what has to happen. So I'm curious to hear what kind of materials are being used by the students in each of their courses, whether they're using a textbook, whether they're using supplemental materials such as cases that have been decided or protocols that have come out or materials from sources such as the Sedona Conference or the American Bar Association, and whether or not as part of their class they have combined practical exercises along with the academic instruction so that they have a sense of whether or not they're being able to actually get a feel for the environment in which they will actually be using these concepts as opposed to just sort of studying them somewhat academically. So if Jared feels like he'd like to share some of his thoughts in that area, that would be a helpful thing.
Sure. Thanks, Victor. Well, we do a little bit of all the things that you mentioned. We're actually, Rob, Andrew, and I are currently in the Advanced eDiscovery eDiscovery course, which is set up as a seminar. In the intro class, we started with Professor Losey's excellent book, eDiscovery, Current Trends and Cases. We went through that to lay the foundation of all the ins and outs of eDiscovery. We supplemented that with all the important cases, you know, starting at the Zuba Lake, working our way forward. We also addressed all the Sedona materials at the same time. And also we looked at Professor Losey's blog and every week had a discussion about things that he was bringing up and also anything else that was going on in the world of eDiscovery. It seems like every week there's a new important case, something interesting to talk about. This semester in our seminar, we're all writing papers, and so it's set up more now that we've had this under our belt one semester. We talk about our paper topics. We talk about the new cases like pension committee, but it's more of a discussion than a lecture. The foundation's been set, and it's actually surprising that after only a one semester, 2-hour course on electronic discovery, our group can sit down and have intelligent and sometimes abstract conversation about difficult issues in electronic discovery, cutting issues, and that's a very satisfying thing. That you know, I mean, not all law schools can have great professors like Professor Losey and Hamilton, but just from one short 2-credit class, the wealth of information we could take from it.
Just to get, since we've got two other schools on the line, and Judge Grimm, you teach a class as well. I was curious if, Justin at the University of Alabama, do you have, course that evolves over time, or do you use technology, in your class? How about that?
Sure, Carl. We, similar to the guys at Florida, use supplemental materials, use a textbook, specifically Judge Shindlin's and Professor Capra's casebook. That's kind of the foundation of our class, but Professor Skinner will also bring in supplemental cases, the pension committee, the Qualcomm order, and kind of a unique thing that she's done with us, because we're kind of an entry-level class, hearing the guys from Florida talk about their that versus their advanced seminar. But she brings in guest speakers that provide a real practical aspect for the class, as far as we've had a representative from LectureNet come in, speak to us, give us accounts, and then we've actually done a workshop assignment, if you will, where we're reviewing documents and then categorizing them just like a real case. and we've also had trial director representatives come in. So that's kind of how we've approached the course, and it's a little bit of case law, current case law with supplemental materials, and then also the practical aspect of how do we actually do this, put these cases to work.
Okay, and Jared, you wanted to add one other thing here, I think. So.
Yeah, one more thing I forgot. One thing that was excellent that we did in the intro course, we actually had the opportunity to have a couple individuals from the technology department of the law school come sit down. We had a mock problem, and we had a role play where the course, we were attorneys, and we were asking the individuals from the technology department questions that you would want to ask. Technology people at a business, at a corporation, during the discovery phase. So that was extremely valuable to get that kind of hands-on role play. It definitely supplemented, the core values, bedrock principles that we took from the text and the cases and the blog and discussions.
Great. And Laura from the University of Texas, did you do anything different? You may not. I mean, we may have exhausted all the things that could happen in these classes.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty much covered. We use Judge Shulman's textbook as well, but then I think, just to be able to keep up with what is still developing, there are going to be supplemental materials. I don't know. I assume most schools use Blackboard, and so we just kind of go through that, and any additional reading we get that way when things come out that are new that we need to be aware of.
Great. And Judge Grimm, since you, from the other perspective, you're teaching these classes at two law schools, how do you put your material together?
Well, I have to make sure that credit is given where due. Mike Berman, who is a lawyer here in Maryland, a very experienced lawyer, he was litigator who was a deputy chief of litigation in the Attorney General's office and has handled a lot of cases involving ESI issues. And Mike has been involved as a member of our court committee that prepared the ESI protocol that we have as a suggested protocol to use in these cases. And he has the primary teaching responsibility now. When we started the course, we were doing it as a co-teacher, and I kind of come in as a guest lecturer a couple of times during the course. But here's how we have done it. We had taken use of the Blackboard platform, which is, of course, great. What we taught was we used case law from the important cases. We would use materials that we would get from the Sedona Conference, of course. We used a number of Ralph's blogs, Ralph Losey's blogs, because they have a perfect way of capturing current issues in their of a length that that you get a lot of bang for your buck when you read them. We have a lot of guest lecturers come in, a lot of them from tech outfits that actually do these types of things. So they're non-lawyers, but they're folks who know how these can be used and the various devices and how to actually structure a search and how the logic of it goes, things of that nature. And then one thing that was done last year was that Carl, and I know Ralph Losey knows Jason Barron. Jason Barron is a well-respected and experienced lawyer who practices representing in litigation matters the National Archives of the United States. And Jason and a professor at the University of Maryland, College Park, the undergraduate school, teach a class to students who are learning electronic records management in their business school. And these are graduate level students. And they teach a class that deals with the technical aspects of electronically stored information. And last year we married our classes up, and one evening our class went down to the University of Maryland, which is about a 15-20 mile hike for our students, and they were taught by the biz professors, and then the biz students came up and They were taught by the lawyers. And then the final projects that each of them had married up the law students with the biz students in a meet and confer under Rule 20F, where the parties were meeting with their ESI experts for the first time to deal with the discovery issues to be able to craft a discovery plan. And there was a hypothetical case that they had been given that gave them the contours of that. So that was very interesting because from the technical side, we were combining the soon-to-be lawyers, the soon-to-be tech management, information management folks with their graduate degrees. And that was really helpful because each separate class from different disciplines obviously got a chance to see what the other side that they will be working with in real life does. And that proved to be very, very, very enjoyable.
Well, that's very interesting. And I'll also mention Justin from the University of Alabama texted and that they do vocabulary tests on Sedona glossary terms to ensure the class is minimally competent on the key tech terms. So I think that's also helpful. Let's jump into some substantive areas, but that was a great overview for anyone thinking about teaching a class or thinking about offering a class of how do you put it together. Ryan Tyler, what's your understanding of the perils of discovery today and what they're doing to the U.S. judicial system? And from what you know, do you think the system's in peril?
Well, my understanding is that the cost of discovery is probably the biggest issue. Going through gigabytes and sometimes terabytes of information, so specifically, it is the biggest thing, and the largest problem, the overall problem that I see is that cost in communicating that to your clients that you represent. But I don't think that the overall system is in peril because the legal system is very adaptable. And for example, we were just going over a case that was just comparing an actual hard copy document to an electronic document and just seeing that, you know, the actual mediums may be different, but the same analysis, the same detailed understanding of the issues that's going to be the same no matter the medium that it's in.
That adaptability is a key point. Good point. In fact, Judge Grimm, you've talked a little bit about maybe some of the adaptations that need to occur in the legal system. You gave a really nice overview at Legal Tech. Do you want to take the podium and talk about some of your thoughts on this, the students, what you think facing the legal community with the e-discovery these days?
Well, I think that Ryan's comment identified what most of the lawyers who are experienced in this area and the judges who deal with this area have come to agree with as well. The students, of course, who are participating in this program and taking the class know that one of the most important rules that governs the discovery process in general, not just e-discovery, is Rule 26B2, which are the cost-benefit balancing tests that are designed to ensure that the discovery process and within that process the ESI discovery is proportional, meaning that the amount that you spend on the everything that you do in the discovery process in order to identify the information, the facts that are necessary to either settle the case or try the case or have the case resolved on motions practice, that the amount of money you spend on those transactions needs to be proportional to what is at issue in the litigation. Now, the proportionality analysis is easier to use when there is a case involving money damages than when there are cases involving principles of civil rights or injunctive relief or declaratory relief. But nonetheless, few people would disagree with the proposition that if you're trying to resolve through a lawsuit a dispute that has a value of between zero and $1 million, it's in no one's interest and it doesn't make a lick of sense if the cost of solving a $0 to $1 million problem is $5 million. And it's certainly possible, given the volume of digital information involved and the issues that come up as to how you preserve and process and then produce and then review for a privilege, how all those steps can cost a lot of money. The answer to the dilemma and the what will trigger the adaptability was a good point that Ryan raised is that first of all, lawyers have to be technically competent in terms of the various types of issues that come up in the ESI, and the younger lawyers coming up through the schools now and who will be entering practice sort of show up with more of the technical competence by virtue of how they deal with these devices that are so second nature to them. And secondly, the manner in which you approach the process requires a change in behavioral attitudes, and this gets into the requirement of cooperation that is not articulated specifically in the rules of procedure, but is the sine qua non, without which there's nothing else, that has to underlie the process, because there's just too much data, and so there must be cooperation, and that requires appreciation of what the Sedona Conference Cooperation Proclamation is about, and the issues that were discussed in the Mancia versus Mayflower case that came out of our court here in Maryland. The readjustment of the approach to discovery to take it from the gratuitously confrontational approach, which comes from a misguided and misinformed perception of what is acceptable behavior as justified by the adversary system, that will have to step aside and be replaced by, at least in the discovery process, where you're discovering the facts upon which the adversary system can then take those facts forward, has to become a more operative process. And I think that if the schools that are forward-looking enough to have these classes understand that, then the students coming into the practice, if they are inoculated with the antidote to the gratuitous combat that has characterized the process in the past, then in time there'll be the attitudinal changes necessary to add to the technical proficiencies that will allow us to achieve the goal of proportional discovery costs.
Great. Now here's you set up this next question real well, Judge Grimm, by talking about Jason Barron earlier. This is a hypothetical question I'm going to give to you, Rob Davis, but it deals with a lot of material Jason Barron's talked about, and actually Ralph Lowes, he's also presented on this topic. What if you, Rob, you're not a law firm, you had a chance between basically following a process which most everyone does, but anyone that studied it agrees is flawed, picking keywords, typing them into a computer, trying to pull documents out, and then reviewing all the documents physically in whatever order you receive them. As a result, you see lots of junk, lots of non-responsive documents. You create large bills. But that's one way to do this. Or you had the ability to experiment with new tools, processes, maybe use some concept searching to design new workflow to maybe sample, not look at everything, but attempt to really attack and improve the process and review less documents. Maybe focus on your hot documents first. What do you think you'd do?
Certainly. Carl, I think it would be very beneficial to perform that focused review, both in terms of not only saving time, but also saving money. We all know that time is a hot commodity for everyone, and reviewing every document, as we've seen in the past, in whatever order you kind of get it in, not only runs up the bill, but it runs down the clock. And not only that, you might lose things, or you might never even find that diamond in the rough you're looking for. So what e-discovery and sampling and these new technologies allow us to to do is to hone our skills, to employ sampling, to kind of really, like you said, focus on the aspects that we're trying to seek in the case. And e-discovery helps. You know, in the days of the bait stamp, there was always a risk that nothing would be in order in any way, shape, or form. With a focus review and results from sampling, you have the opportunity to review a particular document, and not only that, but analyze similar documents, whether in time, whether they were written by the same person, or you know, written about a similar topic. As I mentioned at the beginning of the call, my background really isn't that technical. I was a poli-sci major and really only used computers to draft documents, but not much more. Those days of using the computer like that are gone. After law school, I'm going to be joining a bankruptcy practice group in a firm here in Florida. And not only has the field of law entered the digital world, e-discovery has really infiltrated every aspect of law. Bankruptcy is no exception. I mean, we just saw that the examiner appointed in the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy case had the opportunity to actually review 350 billion pages of email and other documents. Now, I say opportunity because instead of analyzing all those emails and documents, he employed a review strategy that really analyzed only a small portion of those total documents. It saved a lot of time and a lot of money, and I think that's a great example of using the benefits of that focused review. And there's a key point. No one is immune from where we're going, really the benefits of e-discovery. And through sampling, the use of this technology, we have the opportunity to use our knowledge, what we're learning today, to improve this process. So I think that's a long way of getting to the answer of saying I would definitely do the focused review.
Well, I want to take a second because the trustee for the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy happens to be a very experienced lawyer from a very large law firm who is a member of the advisory committee for the Rules of Civil Procedure. So it doesn't surprise me a bit that using that not only experience at the law and also special participation in the rulemaking committee that actually was the source of the recent changes to the Rules of Civil Procedure to deal with ESI resulted in an application of the learning that process brought in, and the application in a real case that saved real money. That's the promise of the future, that if you understand these principles, which obviously he did being on the committee, and I have the privilege of serving with him on that committee, that you can then, in actual practice, put them to use for the benefit of the litigants and society in large to get results that are fair and effective, but also proportional. So that's a great example to use in real life.
Now, Andrew, I'm going to give you a follow-up. Andrew Roy, follow-up question. This is sort of the real-life practical question. You know, you're now a junior associate, you're new on the job, and now you're being told to do something which you believe is inefficient. What are you going to do?
Well, Carl, I think it is, of course, a difficult situation to be put in because you do have the conflict between, the people who are supposed to be telling you what to do, your senior partner, is saying, this is how we've always done it, and we want to continue doing it this way. But I think the most competitive law firms and the firms that will continue to stay competitive or even become more competitive later on, those that will succeed, are those that will begin to adapt to the new technology and utilize multimodal searches and to utilize what Professor Losey calls the Where's Waldo approach. And what that takes is to really have a trust for the junior associates who have always grown up with technology and who do know how to utilize it. And I think that perhaps, Carl, you were quoting Judge Shindlin earlier, I think she might have hit on a little bit, is that there is somewhat a generational gap. And the firms that embrace this generational gap and look to the younger associates and those who have always grown up with technology, and those who have had the e-discovery classes at their law schools, then those are the firms that are going to succeed. And I know it might not carry much weight from coming from a law school student, but that's how I see the future panning out.
Carl, this is Paul Grimm.
Yep.
Interesting to me because in a certain way, this area of law may inaugurate certain amount of leveling of the playing field between the brand new lawyers coming into the practice of law and the lawyers who are more experienced but less technically savvy. We've been hearing, and I'm curious if the professors that we have on the program would agree. And of course, we have a double duty from Ralph Losey because he's an experienced practitioner as well as a professor. But we have heard those of us who have the privilege of teaching law students that many of them get out and they go to firms that can assign them tasks that seem to be mind-numbingly dull and repetitive with little guidance and sort of a whole lot of hazing, it seems like, which is absolutely the worst possible way that you could use bright people who have enthusiasm for the practice. When the firm is wise enough to realize that the new lawyers coming in who are technically proficient and have studied in a organized class such as the students in this podcast, what this is all about, then and I know this to be the case from students of mine who have talked to me about their experience when they've gone out and practice, they become the go-to person that the more experienced people come to because they're the problem solvers. And it doesn't take very long to overcome the "we've always done it this way" to be able to say this is how you, partner, can go back to the client and help the client understand how this is going to save the client money and get better results. And then all of a sudden, the stock of that lawyer, that young lawyer, has risen substantially, and the playing field is a little bit more level.
I'm going to add 2 points before we move into the next question. The first one is, I thought that was a great answer, Andrew. When I was practicing as a young associate at a firm, I chaired and pushed to get a website out there, which I know doesn't sound so great, but at the time, we would have been maybe the 15th or 20th law firm in Pittsburgh to get a website, and we were all lawyers are going to get email. And one of the partners, who's a good friend of mine, said, "But we make money off of faxes. Why would we want to send something for free?" And the answer was exactly what you just said, because everyone else is going to be doing it. It makes sense. And, so lead with your mind. You've got some wonderful skills there. The second thing that I'm going to add is I am doing a podcast coming up with a bunch of young associates that are in e-discovery practices, and how they mentor back to the lawyers they work with, I think, is an interesting topic, so you might want to listen to that one.
Reverse mentoring.
Yes, reverse mentoring. Okay, the other thing that I thought of is an area where you might add some skills, and this will be the University of Texas question, because both Laura's here on the phone, but I'll start off with Josh Norman, who got on as well. Imagine your social life as a project. What tools do you find indispensable to keep in touch with your friends to decide, say, on a Friday afternoon, what you're doing that evening? If you want to talk about the types of tools that you use.
Can you hear me now okay?
Sure.
Okay, sorry about that. I accidentally hung up for like 2 seconds. I think I got the question. It's the question number 7. Is that where we are?
Yeah, and also Josh, I think, is now on as well, so you can both take a stab at this.
Okay. If you want me to go ahead, basically the main tools would be Facebook, Google Chat, basically instant messaging, and or just social networking sites. The main one for us at this level would be Facebook, and then also a couple different chat programs, Facebook Chat or Google Chat are the two common ones, and then also text messaging. Those would be the tools.
Great. And Laura, do you have a good touch with your friends? I mean, do you know what they're doing with these types of tools pretty much all the time?
Yeah, and I would say I'm somewhere probably in the middle as far as which tools I use. I don't do Twitter, but texting and Facebook, I think, are the big ones. And then, like Josh was saying, the Google Chat, where you're basically able to keep in touch with people all the time. And I've talked to my friends about that now, where if they talk to somebody who doesn't really use these tools, they feel like they're disconnected, where we kind of tend to expect to be in constant contact with people. And if you don't have those things, and I've actually had an issue with my phone in the last few months where the memory is pretty low on the kind of phone that I have, and so I had issues with receiving text messages, and I felt like all of a sudden I was out of the loop on anything that was going on, and if someone tried to get in touch with me, I couldn't respond to them, and I was like, oh, everyone's going to think that I'm being rude because I'm not responding to them automatically because we have that ability.
Gosh, I'm late.
Okay, well, that sounds like you guys use these tools. There is a study that's being done right now in the Seventh Circuit, and we're going to do a podcast later on in May, I think, sometime, where they're analyzing cooperation. And one of the hints, you know, this is complete hearsay, you know, but I heard it from an unnamed source, was one of the outcomes that they think that they've happened from analyzing data thus far is the challenges of having parties on the same team work together. Can you imagine a world where you would be talking if you were inside or at a law firm with your client and maybe your technology company that's processing data, maybe with your review team that's in the trenches, and keeping in touch with each other on what's happening in a project? Does that sound crazy to you as a concept, Laura?
You know, I think it's kind of funny because I know that there are certain technologies that have been developed just to, I mean, it's sometimes just difficult to keep in touch with the other attorneys in the same firm. And I'm talking about, I work in a firm with three other people. So if there are problems there where I'm working on something and not recognizing that they're working on the same thing and we're doing two different things at the same time, then that's going to be an issue. And to actually have the parties involved and tech support involved is something that's, I mean, it's not a crazy idea, and there are the certain ways to do it. I know that, I mean, more have been developed lately, but, you know, I think there's a SAPStreamWork.com and a lot of different basic, just within the same firm, a case map type thing where everybody's working into the same website and we're putting all the work saved into the same area, and to actually have that kind of communication would obviously save everyone a lot of time, especially if you have more than one attorney communicating with a client and maybe not keeping up communication with each other on, I talked to them about this and that kind of thing, and just making sure that everybody knows what page everyone else is on.
Okay. That's basically what I have in terms of material. I know we're getting near the end of the show, but I was wondering if anyone there on the line, any of the students, have any questions for either Judge Grimm or myself. You could text them or ask them. I'm happy to add them in at this point. Okay, Andrew, you've got a question. What do you want to ask?
Well, Judge Grimm, my seminar paper that I'm working on for our advanced e-discovery class now focuses on what current e-discovery jurisprudence is, what effect it has on the relationship between an employer and an employee. And kind of what the thesis is behind this is that the e-discovery jurisprudence almost sends a message that, of course, we need to preserve broadly and preserve quickly. And in order for companies and employers to do that, requires them to have these incredible information management systems, because, of course, what the logical step is if we can preserve everything and do it very quickly, then we aren't going to have any possibility of sanctions. And what I see that doing, and what the basis of my paper is that it allows for companies to continue to encroach on employees' personal and private information. That, of course, we don't really embrace that notion here in the United States, but it's something that is embraced in Europe and across the globe in terms of what the employees, what privacy they have at the workplace. And I see that the modern workplace is embracing this notion of employee privacy, but e-discovery is not necessarily allowing that to come into play or come into the balance when judges are making decisions. What do you think about that? Do you see any of this going on?
Well, those are very important questions, because there's sort of an irony that is involved in this area, because although young folks today who put a lot of their personal information on Facebook, who may share information and be in communication with others almost in real time, who may be walking around in a public place, a store or whatever, talking on their cell phones in ways that it can be overheard, and ignoring warnings from their computers that they have at work, saying that the computer's for use at work and there's no expectation of privacy. It's a mistake to conclude, as some, I think, legal scholars in some courts have concluded, that young folks, by virtue of how they use these social devices, have given up the notion that they have an expectation of privacy. I think that's absolutely untrue, and that people still believe that they have an expectation of privacy. And the courts are going to have to come to grips with what is meant by reasonable expectation of privacy within the context of the digital platforms in which we all operate. It's also true that that abroad, in Europe particularly, they have far more protective notions of what information can be disclosed and what is private, and that's led to actually problems in the context of litigation. If you have a corporation that multinational corporation, and you're trying to get information to resolve a dispute pending in the United States, and it requires information from a source of an office of that organization that's a litigant abroad, and you go into that country to try and get what would be immediately discoverable in the United States, and you are told that that's a criminal violation that could result in criminal penalties for violation of privacy interests. So there is no unified, blended approach to this. What we're going to start to see are some signs. My guess is that you're familiar with the Kwan decision that came out of the Ninth Circuit last year. That has been accepted on cert for the Supreme Court to hear, and it will be interesting to see what kind of approach the Supreme Court takes to this issue. In Kwan, you may recall that it dealt with a police officer who was using essentially a cell phone that allowed him to send text messages, and they had an allocated number of characters they could use, and the department was having a lot of problems with people overusing it. And that led to an investigation of what was being done, whether it was business use or personal use. And it turned out that there were, among the uses that were non-business, were communications with an object of his affection, and sending photographs and things of this nature that were highly personal. The company had a computer policy that said that the computers were only for work use, but they had not modified that to talk about this particular digital device. And so the Ninth Circuit found that there were some privacy interests that would sustain a suit back against the employer under 1983 civil rights statute for violating constitutional rights. Now, that's gone up to the Supreme Court, and so it'll be interesting to see what kind of signals the Supreme Court sends when they deal with that. If they send signals that, if you're in the workplace and the boss has got a policy that says if you use this stuff and you're going to be doing that, there's no expectation of privacy, you kind of bargain that away when you sign up to work, then it's going to send things in one direction. If it recognizes that this is that we have to define anew what is meant by privacy, then, of course, that we may see some more nuanced development, and there's a lot of work that has to be done in this area before we have what we can view as the new consensus on privacy. Now, privacy rights and burdens imposed on employees by their employers as a result of duties to preserve information, I believe that eventually, in the not too far distant future, that we will see some greater consensus about what is meant by the duty to preserve. I think that initially, some of the earlier cases made pronouncements that have caused some panic about you have to preserve everything, and if you don't, then you're going to be dead. I think that the two most recent decisions by Judge Shindlin and by Judge Rosenthal are wonderfully helpful opinions to kind of synthesize the law that has not always been consistent and is emerging. There is within the careful reading of these two important cases the ability to see a time in the future when, particularly as Judge Rosenthal said, the duty to preserve and the sanctions analysis has to be looked at in terms of what's done that's reasonable and what is proportional. And I believe at the end of the day that's the position that's going to prevail. And when that happens, one hopes that it will clarify the obligations that the employers have and at the same time reassure them that they don't have to sort of become information autocrats with regard to their dealings with their employees in order to meet some real or perceived obligation to preserve data. So it's the simple answer to that is there's going to be a lot of litigation out there trying to decide those contours, and for all of the students who are participating in this telephone conference call, I hope you all get to be parties or lawyers representing parties in that litigation, because that would be exciting and important litigation.
Great. Okay. Ryan Tyler also had a question. So
yes, my question had to do with search methodologies. I was in our class, we read over the Victor Stanley decision, and I was just had a question about the practice points. I guess my question had to do with the practice points that were established in that case. Now, when you're going over a large set of documents, you have your tools like keyword searching, concept searching. But I guess from my mathematical background, the thing that pops up in my head is some type of, I guess, self-correcting algorithm, which is just a set of instructions for a computer to carry out. And I guess the question that I had is comparing that and kind of letting a computer kind of search through documents almost for relevancy versus the actual human input of having someone, having a lawyer or a document reviewer going through those documents themselves. How comfortable are most courts in kind of shifting that over to, I guess, a little bit more of an automated process versus actually having a document reviewer go through those?
I'll take a first stab, but I know Judge Grimm's got perspective from the court. I think the first problem is how comfortable are the lawyers and the parties involved, because they oftentimes they pick their process. The court really doesn't get involved unless there's a dispute. It's right now the battles are more on concept searching versus keywords. There are some automated tools that are out there, it's just going to take some time for people to get comfortable with these different types of options. But people got to be trying them and figure out, you know, what makes sense.
From my perspective, there's you can begin to glean what the reaction of the courts might be from a couple of different things. First of all, they're cases, and you've got some other information out there. That there's a best practices piece that the Sedona Conference has that Jason Barron worked on writing, which talks about best practices in conducting search and information retrieval methodologies, and that's cited in the Victor Stanley case. More recently, in the advisory committee notes to the newly enacted Federal Rule of Civil Federal Rule of Evidence 502 that deals with problems that were associated not only in ESI discovery but also in broader discovery with the waiver of attorney-client privilege and work product protected information, which is certainly a much easier thing to happen when you're dealing with terabytes of information than it was when you had just a single box of litigation of hard copy documents in a banker's box. But as part of Rule 502B that says that if you inadvertently produce work product protected or privileged information, then it doesn't constitute a waiver if reasonable steps were taken before you produced it to avoid the disclosure of privileged or protected information. And if you look at the advisory committee notes, it says as a specific example of the type of activity that is going to be an indicia of reasonableness is the use of computer-based search methodology. It's my view that eventually the only rational solution to this whole issue is going to be to turn the source of the problem into the source of the solution. And it's clear from some of the research done in the TREC legal TREC research that Jason Barron has talked about, that's referred to in some of the footnotes in Victor Stanley, that while lawyers from the old school believe that the best way to catch privileged and protected information is eyeballs on every single thing, studies that have been done show that the best that they do is about 20% accuracy. So that means 80%, they missed 80% of the things that they should have caught. Well, computers can get you better than that if you use multiple different ways of doing it. But the incentive to get a computer modeling that can use various modalities in order to do effective non-human searches, to at least process, to remove things so that you can you can winnow down the volume that you're looking at, combined with the judicious use of personal review of a smaller subset, with proper selection of search tools and methodologies, and taking into consideration notions of misspellings and using the tools that are certainly out there that can assist you in that process, I don't think the courts are going to have the slightest bit of hesitation to jump on board and approve that. And indeed, Victor Stanley and our my friend and colleague Judge John Fasciola's decisions in the O'Keefe cases, talks about how you have to decide the search methodology appropriately and show that you have done more than just grab a half a dozen keywords out of the air and throw them on the problem. But if you've done that, I think the courts are going to expect it, and they're going to endorse it. So I think that's the more progress we get in refining it and getting better results with it and showing that the results can be good, the more that's going to advance the ball.
Great. And our last question is from Joshua Norman from the University of Texas.
Yes, I basically just had a question how it interrelates with, I guess there's some interweaving of attorney-client privilege also in this, and also electronic discovery, in the sense that if I'm an attorney or I'm opposing another side's attorney and I know that they're using something like Yahoo Mail, Google Instant Messaging, Google Mail, where all that the communications they're using, or the company they're representing or whatever, using that, and there's a bunch of communications going back and forth that are stored on the third-party servers, I know that. How much of that, like in the future, can we assume that that stuff is still attorney-client privileged and protected from discovery, even though, like, for instance, I know that when I send an email, it's in plain text, it's held on that third-party servers for whatever their policies are, and maybe even indefinitely backed up. I mean, how much of that, I guess we can go several different ways with that question, but.
Well, it's actually a very interesting question, because cloud computing involves storage of information outside the machinery that's owned by the entity using the cloud. I mean, that's the whole purpose of it. It's stored off-site. You may back it up to stuff that you control or make copies yourself in terms of folders that you have on your own hardware, but you're storing the stuff elsewhere. And there's a legal issue about whether or not if I send a text message or I use Google Chat or one of those other methods of communication that you talk about, and I send a communication to my lawyer, and that communication, in fact, is routed through the cloud and is stored in a third-party server, have I somehow waived the privilege by having allowed it to be communicated through a medium that will allow it to be hosted, if you will, by a third party whose presence, if you made the communication in face-to-face with them, would vitiate the privilege because they were not within the protected number of people that you could communicate to and keep the privilege. That's a neat little legal issue. I think a court addressing that issue would obviously have to follow black-letter law about what constitutes attorney-client privilege waiver, but I don't think that... I think an effective argument that could be made, and if effective, hopefully it would at least inform the decision by the court, would be, just because it's stored in a third-party provider, given the fact that the Stored Communications Act imposes some pretty significant penalties on holders and providers who allow access to this information without certain restrictions, without requirements of court orders, that there's sufficient limitations on that being available that by communicating in a fashion that allows it to be stored in a third-party server does not vitiate the privilege because it was in the digital presence of a third party. You all probably know this much better than I, but in the news last week was a discussion about what's known as the digital due process movement, which is a collection of interesting sources to include, I think, Google and Apple and a lot of other folks who are considered to be at the forefront of information technology, trying to get a collection of bills passed through Congress that will take a look at some of these things and harmonize some of the statutes that the Stored Communications Act, I think, was passed in the 80s, and imagine the technology that existed then trying to write it into a law that's being applied now. So I think what's going to happen is that if you're storing it in a fashion that is it is reasonable to believe that there was an expectation of confidentiality associated with the manner in which you communicated, that you're not going to lose the privilege just by having done that. On the other hand, if you post communications with your lawyer on your Facebook, and the general thing where people can have access to it, and others who are not part of that communication have access, then you're going to have some problems. I'm not sure that answered your question, but I think that's the gist of what you were inquiring about.
Yeah, I think it's the key is the password. Did you have an expectation to keep it from others? There's looseness all over the place. There are cleaning companies that walk into law firms that can sometimes see privileged material. I mean, you don't want it to happen, but in the real world, there is the ability for people to see things they shouldn't have. We don't live in Fort Knox, unfortunately, or fortunately, I should add. But that's those were great questions, and I know we ran just a little bit long, but I thought this was an excellent show, and I wanted to thank you, Judge Grimm, for helping me moderate this unique show. It's always a pleasure to have you on to share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and I hope to do more shows with you later this year. And to the law students who are still on, some of them ran off the class, but I want to thank you for sharing your very unique insights. I know many people are looking to help find a solution to e-discovery mess, and I should add, if anyone wants to look for you, give me 30 minutes to add email addresses onto the show description at ESI Bytes. People can contact the law students. Maybe you get a job out of this. Who knows? But to the listening audience, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. And you can also remember our show on the website phonetically as Easy Bytes, which is how it sounds out of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, just come to ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.
Thank you very much, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.